into my apartment, like drop my stuff at my door, and then I just turn, and in my kitchen there's just like a pile of Coca-Colas. I was like, this is like the most native thing, like, because growing up on the res, there's just always like Cokes.
Yeah, for sure.
And I remember when my dad switched to Coke, Diet Coke, and he was like, here, we got a Diet Coke now.
Okay, healthy.
Coke now. I'm dying from Coke.
Welcome to Also Cool Sounds Like. I'm Tashina Boswa, guest hosting this episode. You may have heard me last season on the podcast being interviewed with my band Love Language, but today I'll be asking the questions. On the show, we feature the stories and creative journeys of musicians in and around Jojage, or Montreal. We're having conversations about where their musical inspiration comes from, what keeps them going, and what navigating the industry is like today. For this episode, I had the pleasure of sitting down with Ambigaze. Ambigaze is a collaboration between two Anishinaabe musicians who each have their own projects. Adam in the alt-rock band Status Non-Status, and Daniel in their solo work under the name Zune, which they describe as moccasin gaze. With my band Love Language, I had the pleasure of opening a show for Ambigaze in the summer of 2022, and I was instantly hooked by their intense live performance and sound. As an Indigenous person myself, it felt amazing to witness other Native musicians taking up space in the indie rock scene, something I rarely get to see. To be able to interview these two was an absolute honor, and our conversation has stuck with me in a major way since. Welcome. Can I get you both to introduce yourselves, please?
Yeah, I'm Daniel Monkman.
Adam Namandishnikas.
Miigwech, thank you so much. Yeah, let's just like get into it. How did you meet each other?
Adam and I, on our own journeys, we're always trying to find collaborations with people who maybe are doing the same kind of thing. And so that's how we met, was just through music and kind of through our management too, kind of lined us up. But we understood that there wasn't maybe many Anishinaabe artists doing the same thing. So it was easier for us to kind of like be like, yo, you're doing cool stuff. You're doing cool stuff. Let's maybe do that together at some point.
We talked online a fair bit through that introduction, and then we met in Hamilton at one of my shows. We were playing with Julie Doran, I think 2016, 17 or so. But it does feel like yesterday.
And how did you each get started in music?
I used to like watch The Wedge and like wait for Nirvana videos to come on to Much Music. And then I would strap on a tennis racket and pretend to be playing music.
Well, I got introduced to music just growing up on the reservation. When my grandma was alive, my kokum, we would have family reunions. They would lay out like a little platform, and then different relatives would play music, and us kids would sit there and watch them, and they would play like traditional like fiddle music, like Métis stuff. I just remember really enjoying watching my family dance around. And then after my grandma passed away, the family divided and no one did that thing again. And then music was kind of like not taken out of my life, but then it just was absent. Before YouTube and stuff, you could like download music videos, or you could download Dragon Ball Z videos that were like synced up to music, like from like LimeWire. And I remember one time, Come As You Are, Nirvana was synced up to one of the Dragon Ball Z videos, and being like, whoa, this is really cool music. So I found my way into listening to like Chet Atkins and then like learning guitar that way. And when I first started, I was always like trying to finger pick. And that's kind of how I first started, was like just that journey of like hearing music and then being like, how do I do it?
And then both of us, we connected over Beck, Mellow Gold.
Yeah.
That was very early informative record for both of us.
Yeah,
I was like a kid going to the swimming pool with mixtapes that my sister's older boyfriends were giving to her that she didn't like. And anyway, side note, but Daniel and I really were informed by that record and Nirvana, of course. I just seem to remember that being like something that we really talked about before we made the record. But when we first met, it was always right there in the back of our minds. And so we have like a few really distinct mutual interests between us that have like connected us, you know, connected our whole musical beings together. So it's kind of nice that way.
Where does your name come from, Ambigaze?
It means to be noisy, not necessarily in a like bold or beautiful way. There's other words for that. This is more like to like squawk and make noise and be kind of loud and maybe even obnoxious. Mm. You know, we're learning and always trying to learn. A part of that is imbuing language into our art practice. It's a double-edged sword because, you know, as Indigenous artists, we're often put on a pedestal with weights on our shoulders, and we're not cultural leaders or language experts or any of those things. We're artists, and hopefully there's something special about art, but our goals around putting language out there is challenging people to use the language, challenging people to say it. It doesn't really bother us when people say it wrong because we want to bring people to us. Mm-hmm. We're not trying to have it be subversive or anything like that. We just want it to be something that is present, that lives today. And we try to find like obscure words that aren't really being used too. And that's a part of the practice. And we thought that that would like inform our sound too. It felt like it was like what we were going to be.
Growing up as a Native kid myself, who was very into indie rock, I often felt like I had like no place in the indie rock scene, which felt and still feels very whitewashed. I'm curious if either of you ever felt the same way, and if so, what was the moment where you felt like no, I actually can do this and I actually can take up space in this world?
I think like early on growing up, but then when I got into the music scene, it became like even more apparent because it's already such a small community, like musicians. So you're just like okay, and I feel very, not outnumbered, but just like maybe alone in it. And a big part of the reason why I left and why I struggled a lot was because of that, taking on all that kind of pressure and racism and stuff. It really does take a toll on you. Like I was just in Winnipeg and I was at a bank, and having like a lot of Native presence in that city, I could just see how challenging it is, you know, and the wear and tear on your mind from it eventually breaks you down. And I experienced that, and I left and I quit music for a while and I got sober and went to rehab and didn't think that I would ever do it again. After a few good years of like being dedicated to my recovery, I was in London, Ontario, and I was with my friend, and we were having lunch, and I looked up on the whatever TV was there, and I saw Jeremy Dutcher, and it just all of a sudden clicked to me. I was like, maybe right now is the time to start doing music again. And I got like a phone and started going on the internet again and seeing kind of like the like a resurgence in Indigenous music. And that kind of kickstarted wanting to do music again.
There continues to be a lack of presence and a lack of awareness. You know, I was alone doing it for a long time. We'd play shows and be like, oh, I really like that band, but like kind of like too much of the politics, eh? And that would really bother me for a long period of time. But I realized that it's really important to show up and that our culture moves. My favorite teaching, and I shouldn't be picking favorites, is futurisms. And the only way to find a future is to understand your past. And it's a really, really important thing. And we still just aren't really able or capable of having the discussions around these things in Canada. And, you know, music can be like a light version of it, but we can be present. I have so much respect for my culture and my traditions and my teachings and the knowledge that's been shared with me. It's not my knowledge. It's been shared with me. But I don't like present like other people. So I haven't like experienced racism in the way that visible people have, but I've experienced the inversion of that. It's like, oh, but you're not that kind of Native. You're not, that's not who you are. Like, you're part Native. Or growing up, I was told I was Métis, and I'm not Métis at all. And so those are the things that hurt me inside. But that's just my story. We have to come to the table, like, just providing our spoke in that wheel. And when you sit in a circle's infinite. Mm-hmm. It's something that grows. And so if I share my story and you share your story and you share ours, we're going to find some similar aspects to it, but we don't have to, like, put ourselves into a hierarchy or fall into colonial narratives mm-hmm. about who and what we are mm-hmm. and how people perceive us. I'm a representative of my family mm-hmm. and the teachings that are coming back to us through that mm-hmm. experience. And so I'm wearing the weight of my ancestors really hard. And a lot of people in indie rock just don't have to do that. Mm-hmm. I'm a big Chad Van Galen fan, but Chad mm-hmm. Van Galen can, like, go on stage and ask people for weed and make fart jokes and make inappropriate comments. Sorry, Chad. But, like, we can't.
Yeah.
And so that's a reality that we're faced with. Or, like, you know, the first song I wrote was this song called Beaujou. It was just me learning how to say the word hello. Mm. It was an instrumental song because I was learning about the teaching of this rabbit character that traveled the land. And I just wanted to make a song that was confused and narrative musically. And it is not anything other than me learning the word Beaujou or something. And then it's like, yeah, you get thrust into the spotlight that is very harmful. Mm-hmm. That's like the thing that's challenging, I find. But the presence in indie rock, it's not there. Mm-hmm. It's not, you know, mm-hmm. when we run into someone like you, it's like, holy moly, there's someone else, you know, and it sticks out. Mm-hmm. And you remember that.
Would you label your music as political? And what are your thoughts about the intersection of Indigenous music and politics?
Yeah, I think it is. Like, to my point of respecting my culture a lot, I didn't always know my place. I didn't know whether I was supposed to be an ally or assert my identity. And I work in the community. It's really important that I contribute to my community, which is focusing on the young people. And then learning those teachings. That's the way that I function and operate. But I never really thought that it was appropriate to, like, cross that line, like what Daniel was saying, like going into the bar. Like, you know, I'm sober now. So it's like, maybe I will wear a ribbon shirt at a show. Mm-hmm. Like, maybe I will play a drum at the show. I always kind of, like, thought that my traditional stuff was, like, meant for a private sort of environment. I spent a lot of time healing in the sweat lodge and doing that stuff and picking up songs and carrying those songs and doing work that was existing in a circle of care so that I could go back out into the world and become the better person that I would like to be. So I do put that into my music. I try to put the best of myself, or the most pain, or the you know, the most of every circumstance into my art. The spirit in me is my family, the past and the future together. It's really hard to live up to that, you know? Hmm. It's like, I can't be the spirit in me when I have a toothache or I'm tired or whatever. Yeah. Like, lately I've been singing that song and I'm kind of like, I actually think I'm kind of like a bit angry right now. It's like, am I this song? Am I living up to these words right now? So I think it's really something that we do have to be careful with, crossing the boundaries. So those are my politics around Indigenous art. They're just my opinion. And it would be easier for me to put the politics and like the awareness building into it, as opposed to certain cultural significances or like what I was wearing, or if I was like maybe carrying a drum or something like that.
I feel like it will always kind of just be political at this point, because it's still just so fresh, you know? Like, I learned so much about the residential schools and the Indian day schools just over the last 3 years. I learned so much about the actual depths of it, and it wasn't too long ago too. You know, like in Manitoba, I think like 1996 was the last one that shut down. And there hasn't been much healing, so it's like, I feel like it's just like we're not at that point to like be able to like move on and have the white picketed fence house or something. Like, it's like no matter what, I think it's just always going to come out political, even if you're not political. I think just being alive is, you know, political. You're kind of just like born into this.
Like, you don't have a say almost.
Cherry Coke is political in nature, or like we always open with the song Yahweh, and it's a way for us to put our work into action. Still I wonder where I go, hills I roam. Still I wonder. Maybe that's not something that maybe people will always pick up on, or you know, maybe we take it for granted. And I'm just listening to you talk, and then all your words are running through my head, and all the songs. I'm like, it's all political. It's all cultural. It's all teachings. But you know, maybe just to the average listener, if they heard the song and they didn't hear that we were Indigenous or something like that, they would just hear a song. And maybe it would make them think of, you know, a lot of our work is family. So a lot of people get that. I think sometimes I also think that like people are avoiding us because
how political it is?
For how healthy it is. or something.
Like
we're sober and we're healing and we're doing these things. So it's like, it's not like, oh, we got to go party and mosh at the Ombikase show or something like that. We're going to get smashed. And it's like, no, it's okay. It's fine.
No, I have a lot of Winnipeg friends who, don't drink around me. But as Indigenous people, I think it's just, that is words that we use in our gatherings a lot too, you know? Like in our sweat lodges or ceremonies, it's always like, you can't be under the influence. Because I think we know that that stuff is just meant to bring us down. It's meant to like trap us. You know, it was used against us to sell the land, and now it's used it against us to like sell our soul or something. I don't know.
I definitely hear what you're saying, and that's really interesting, because as an Indigenous person, I actually drink. I question it all the time. I'm like, should I be doing this? Like, I know like our people say it's better to abstain, but then I think there is a way to like walk that line, but do you even want to walk that line to begin with? And I don't know. So it's interesting for me to hear that from you guys. And I know that a lot of Indigenous artists and musicians in general do tend to just not go there.
Harm reduction in the music industry is really important. Like as we get older, it's like a lot harder. Like we're not sleeping on floors as much anymore, and we can't really do that. And, you know, there's always a drink ticket or something. So, you know, I think harm reduction is like the best approach for anybody. And, you know, we don't cast judgment on anybody, you know, to my point of like putting the politics in our culture and putting that stuff forward. Like I did learn, like I have been a sober performer for a really long time. I had an epiphany moment where it was like the first time I ever played sober was like the most powerful show I'd ever played. And I left it all on stage. And I made the decision that day to just do that. But, you know, I would have some drinks after the show or whatever. And, you know, it's just about being responsible more than anything, I think. But, you know, it is also important that, you know, if there was someone else here who is a indigenous drinker or something like that. And I'm sure that they could make lots of good arguments for normalizing it. You know, there's this stereotype of indigenous people and alcohol, and that was given to us, like Daniel said. And so there was a perpetuation in movies and et cetera about how that was being perceived. Hmm. Our communities aren't necessarily like that, by the way. Mm-hmm. We have some trauma that creates some addictive tendencies. In my household growing up, it was binge drinking. So my household was sober, mm-hmm. and very militant and, like, you know, sort of very calibrated. And then it would fall off that path and it would go into something kind of violent and
swing the opposite way. Yeah.
Yeah. So the pendulum would swing. So there was no balance. Mm-hmm. And all we seek to do is walk in balance. Our greatest mm-hmm. teacher was Zaki Chuck and Nana Bojo, this mm-hmm. rabbit trickster character. Mm-hmm. He created and named all the things, and some of them are good and some of them are bad. And he, like, makes mistakes, he or she, and also does beautiful things. And that is what life is those things. And so we have to kind of navigate that and find that balance, Mano Bamatsuin, to mm-hmm. live the good life. Mm-hmm. So for us right now, our good life is our sobriety, and we're finding that strength in each other. Mm-hmm. Pretty much our whole band is mainly sober. There's a drinker, but mm-hmm. that's just where we're at. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you can be at wherever you need to be in the journey. That's totally cool.
In 2022, Ambigaze released the album Sewn Back Together, which received widespread acclaim and was shortlisted for the Polaris Prize. The album itself explores how personal and family histories intersect and expresses the respect Adam and Daniel have for each other as artists and collaborators. I asked them what it was like making the record with their bandmates and producer Kevin Drew of Broken Social Scene.
So we made the record with Eric Lorenzo, who plays drums and also plays in Status Non-Status, and then Sunsetter, Andrew McLeod, who plays in Zune and has their own project, Sunsetter, and Sonny's like a multi-instrumentalist, really talented. And then our live band also includes Derek Durant. Derek is Mohawk, and he plays keys, and it's his birthday today. And he's a gentle, beautiful soul. He's so kind, and really, really helped us reimagine the songs live. Not by saying too much, but he just, like, kind of taught us how to play them over again.
The fear of going into the studio is, like, if you can cross over that fear, it actually becomes a very beautiful experience. But if you're just thrown into it, it can be really, really scary. Like, we have a session coming up and I'm terrified. Now people think of me as kind of a lo-fi artist, and when the reality of it is, like, I want to be in a studio, but I'm just, like, slowly working my way up to it, you know? Yeah. And, you know, some people start off that way.
Yeah.
But doing this has made me feel, like, a little more confident as a songwriter and trusting myself and being like, you know, I can just write something very quick.
Yeah.
But that you always want it to be sacred.
What I've loved about working with Kevin is that he doesn't like that. He just wants it raw. So a lot of what you hear is the first take of something, or, you know, even though it's like high fidelity or something like that, you know, you can still hear the, mm-hmm. oh, the guitars are a little bit out of tune. You know, some of those elements that, like, make Social Scene's music so beautiful. And having worked with him gives new insight on that band, which is, like, really cool too.
What is the lyric writing process between you two? Are either of you the primary lyric writer, or is it pretty much split in two?
I think we're still just kind of, like, figuring that out. We're learning how to collaborate more, so we are doing more sharing. But the first record was, like, a little bit more like, you bring my thing. Mm-hmm. And I think the new stuff is a little bit more of melding our strengths and stuff like that, which is kind of cool, you know. I think Daniel keeps it really like simple and pointed. Mm-hmm. And then sometimes I can like really ramble. When I write lyrics, I usually will just like go to town. I'll just go stream of consciousness, like let it all out. Mm-hmm. And then I kind of will just like edit that. Yeah, we have sort of two different approaches and yeah, it seems to work pretty well.
Yeah, we're just kind of entering that process of the new record too. We're going to make like have a theme for the record.
Yeah.
And maybe when we're writing individually, keep that in mind.
Right.
Like the first one was kind of just bring our own songs. And then there was a little bit of like spirit in me, mm-hmm. but Adam did, it took the lead for that.
Yeah.
But musically for that record, we were like really trading ideas. So this one, I think there'll be more of the lyrical. As you hear the sound of concrete, residential military,
white picket fences at the cemetery. Residential military. This is an amazing song. Birchbark Canoe merges onto the freeway. Birchbark Canoe merges onto the freeway. That is such an amazing line. Like, what an opener. Listening to the song, the lyrics are abstract, but at the same time, kind of paint this clear picture of like maybe a boy trying to escape residential school. That's what I got from that imagery. Can you tell us more about like the story behind the song or what it's about?
Yeah, I mean, it could be that, I think, in a way. It could be any Indigenous story. I think, you know, we were talking about futurisms. Mm-hmm. And so I always find it really challenging to contextualize traditional teachings into a modern world. You know, mm-hmm. people talk about spirit animals and like these sort of superfluous things that don't actually have foundational roots mm-hmm. in our clan system and our like way of being was actually really like about like how does that animal exist in the environment and adapt to the world around it. Mm-hmm. And so when you take on the role of that clan animal, you have sort of this responsibility to put that into a human experience. Mm. And so it's really hard to live with a traditional mindset in a modern world. And that's what that opening line was about, was like, how do I exist? How do I connect to my past? Mm. How do I put in the work? How do I honor those ancestors that were in those places, at those schools? It's an honor song in a way for my grandfather, who was not allowed to be himself and was a military person as well. Mm. So that's the residential military. It was like trying to just like understand how this person had to do that and then was left behind in the modern world, or had to pretend to not be that, you know? Okay. And then for my family to pick up those pieces, my dad and my aunt being the first of a generation to exist outside of the system as non-status people. Mm. And the opportunity to try and tell those stories, but to do so in an abstract way is totally fine. Palace lower into slumber accelerator, time reflex and futures.
Cherry Coke is just the most poignant and tender song to me. Lyrically, it evokes these sort of like primal core feelings and memories. And it's especially emotional song for you, of course, Daniel, as it's dedicated to your late father. How did this song come to fruition?
I have many half-finished songs, full songs, you know, in my batch of memos. And while at the studio, I was struggling with the... maybe feeling underprepared a bit, being like, these songs that I do have maybe aren't as good. And so Ab and I were standing outside and I was like, maybe I'll try to find this one song I want to show you that I think could be good for this project. And we were just sitting out there flipping through my iPhone, and then it came to the song, and I was like, I think I could figure out the tuning. And then we just like went our kind of own ways while I was trying to like figure it out. So we just dug it out, and then we changed it, I think, the strumming a bit, and that's just kind of how it came to be.
So you wrote it in the studio, basically?
Yeah, yeah. I had
with the thread of the idea.
Yeah, like the more fleshed out idea, because there was an old demo that I did for, but it was a little bit more experimental with like feedback guitar and stuff like that. It wasn't like an acoustic ballad.
Okay, yeah.
But the version that we played from my phone was just me on an acoustic.
Okay.
So we just kind of ran with it, and then I tuned acoustic to it and then played it for Adam and Kevin, and everyone was like, okay, let's do that song next. Cherry Coke, Cherry Coke.
Recently in an Exclaim interview, Daniel, you commented on Adam's other project, Status Non Status, and you said that Adam doesn't always necessarily make the most accessible music despite his role as like a knowledge keeper and a leader. He's a true ogama, and how much you like admire the integrity of that. So to me, Ambigaze sounds like a bit more accessible musically. So what's the balance between making music that's true to you and accessibility?
I think Adam and I are capable of making like very mundane, accessible music if we wanted to. But the thing is, we don't want to. We want to like make something that's like has sustenance. And I guess that's what I meant when I said that, is that it's not an easy route to go down, the mundane, accessible route, but it is the safest, you know? And when we're trying to make leeway with representing us doing this type of music, it's just like important to like be brave and to do that kind of stuff, you know? That's something that I love about our collaboration, is that we're not just like stuck in one little spot. We're like, as Indigenous people, like we don't have like, say, like Michigan or something with like, or Detroit, where all this like culture of like iconic music is coming out. So we're trying to like fit in spaces and all kinds of spaces. With Ambigaze, we tried to like get both of those worlds, all of those areas, the spectrum of music, but also like have that integrity that some people might lose. Like Adam was talking about like Chan Van Galen or something like
we love you, Chad Van.
Yeah. Or like Andy Shaw.
Target. No. Target.
I know what you mean, though.
Just like even Andy Shaw, where like his album, his new one's called Norm. And he's like, I just wanted to make an album about nothing, you know?
Yeah.
But it's all government funded, you know?
Yeah.
And it's just like,
yeah.
It's like, okay, well, then just do that. I don't know.
Well, so I think that weight that we carry sometimes, like the content is hard and heavy, and the music needs to be a reflection of that. And I think for my own sense, like I got a taste here and there where it's like, oh, all of a sudden maybe one song actually is kind of striking a chord with people, and you know, it's the perfect balance of me being as challenged as I can be as a writer and then also reaching people. I think that that's like the ultimate compliment. But I think there was also times where I was like, oh, like it would be really helpful if I could get a song on Radio 3 and like maybe that could pay my rent or something like that. And maybe I went too far that way. And now that that's gone, it's almost like a little bit of a weight's lifted off the shoulders. It's like, well, let's just get back to like making kind of like strange music. You know, those are our interests too. So it's like pretty, it's, you know, to break it down really simply, it's just like, we just want to make kind of quirky, weird stuff.
Yeah.
And if it's got like a little bit of approachability to it, that's a bonus.
Like an entry point at some point. Yeah, for sure.
And I mean, everyone likes a catchy song. Everyone wants to bop their head. Everyone wants to jump up and down. And so do we. So that does happen once in a while. And we hit those chords. And it's really nice to bounce ideas off of other people who have a different approach. You know, Daniel makes these like sprawling songs that are so layered and beautiful, and and I find it like really inspiring to hop on top of those, and you know, like we kind of like to make a lot of riffs over top of that music, and so we're adding a new element together that's maybe making it more easy for other people to hear it, but we're still mm-hmm. doing our thing.
You have received widespread acclaim, being shortlisted for the Polaris Prize and playing at the Junos. As Indigenous artists, what is it like being accepted by Canadian music industry awards such as these?
I think we're always trying to find success and sustainability, you mm-hmm. know? Sometimes that means showing up to these things and being visible to them. But then sometimes we find out the truth of these places and it makes us like upset. Mm-hmm. And we're just like, why are we like participating in this garbage? But then we meet a lot of nice people there. And so then we're like, there's a camaraderie to it of being like, okay, like this is maybe just part of it. Mm. But we're always trying to build our own piece of it.
Yeah, I don't feel too welcome, but yeah. That's fine. Mm. We've gotten some acclaim that's like pretty nice, but I think to Daniel's point, it's like, well, how do we actually create sustainability? And like so much of the music industry is put on the artist's back, but then the artists are the ones that are suffering the most and mm-hmm. like going through really rigorous, challenging, unsafe things to just make it all work. And so that goes beyond being Indigenous. We're just doing things for the right reason for us, you know, and we always, always, always come back to our families because we have them and we have that and we're lucky for those things. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we honor them. Mm. And, that's like kind of like where we, when it's all said and done, that's where we got to go, is back home to our families. We always go home. Mm-hmm. That's what's actually important. And if we can make it sustainable, then we can take care of them.
In the liner notes of Sewn Back Together, author Wabgishig Rice writes the following. The Anishinaabe revival is accelerating. Our artists are becoming more resurgent in all realms, telling the stories, singing the songs, and creating the imagery to further solidify our everlasting presence on this land. The Anishinaabe sonic revolution is richly layered and wide-reaching, inspiring and influencing all generations to gather, sing, and speak, as we've always done. And at the core of this renewal are artists like Ambigase. I asked Adam and Daniel what the Anishinaabe revival means to them and what Ambigase's place is in that revival.
And just like one spoke in the wheel, you know, filling in the gaps, you know, if we're the only ones that are present in a particular environment, then we're representing ourselves and our communities in good ways. And then also helping reshape the narrative and trying to tell the truth through our stories. And just always be inventive. As Indigenous people, we're storytellers, and so that's what we're gonna do.
It's incredible to help build a better future. Mm. It's kind of like the most important thing in a lot of ways. When you think about, like, I have a song called "A Language Disappears," and on my solo project, and I named the song that because I used to have a fear of a language, like, coming to a place where there is no Anishinaabe fluent speakers or anything. You know, like, I remember before the Ojibwe dictionary online was available, it was like, how would you learn? I used to go on YouTube and look at watch this guy who would teach me, and I'm like, I don't even know if this guy's alive anymore. I don't know where he is, you know. This was just some recording on YouTube. That always like was alarming to me. I was like, does anyone ever experience this? Any kids around me, like these people that I would hang out with in my hometown, like, would they ever do they have that in the back of their mind? Like, should a young person be worrying about something like this? And I just felt like it was a very abstract perspective on life and something that always stuck with me, you know, like I remember going to live with my dad back on the reservation and going to Sergeant Tommy Prince School, which Sergeant Tommy was the most decorated war veteran, like Indigenous war veteran. And he ended up dying on the streets of Winnipeg, unhoused and died of alcoholism, and sold off all of his medals and stuff like that.
Oh, man. Yeah.
And when I was attending that school, I was so excited to learn Ojibwe.
Yeah.
And the Ojibwe teacher came for the first day and taught us how to count 1 to 10 ABCs. And then the next day he's just gone. And we heard that he went to Winnipeg and was just disappeared. And that was pretty common. And it was instances like that, that made me feel like, wow, if we don't have leadership for these youth, like we're not paving any kind of road. It's like roads and Gatwin or whatever, that French place where just potholes everywhere. Like it's just trying to like veer you off the side to kill you or something, you know? And that's not a good way to set the future. I think that's a role that we're trying to do in any kind of way that we can. You know, we kind of stretch ourselves pretty thin trying to get these messages out. But I mean, if the church and if the Mormons are out there like going house to house working overtime, then that's what we got to do too. You know,
do it right back at them.
You get to do it with guitars.
Yeah.
Coming up to the end of the interview, my last question, what's next for Mbigize?
We have a couple summer festivals. We're excited to go up to Folk on the Rocks, Yellowknife.
Probably
doing like some workshops up there too, and like trying to connect with some local knowledge keepers and community people and stuff like that. It feels important when we're visiting places as guests to like do that connective work. It is a part of truth and reconciliation, but it's also just a part of like what we do as community members. So we're excited for that. And then I think we get like a little bit of time off in the fall, like hopefully a little bit of touring, but we're kind of like just going to be winding down a little bit. It's been a really busy, hectic time.
Year for you guys. Yeah.
Yeah. Everything to that. Nice. Just like a few festivals scattered out and then some rest to write.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much for joining me today. This has been amazing. I've loved talking to both of you. Thank you. Miigwech.
Miigwech. Oh.
Yeah, Gaegi.
This episode of Also Cool Sounds Like is hosted by myself, Tashina Buswa, and was produced and edited by Aviva Lassard and Gwen Rowley in collaboration with Also Cool magazine. Shout out to the Also Coolers Malaika Astorja, Zoe Argyropoulos Hunter, Holly Hiltz, and Rebecca Judd for their editorial support. Our intro music is by Jacob Lassard, and the show's artwork is designed by Vasco Caballero. Check out the magazine at alsocoolmag.com or on Instagram at alsocoolmag. We'll include a link to Ambigaze's music in the show notes, as well as a link to my band Love Language. Don't forget to rate and subscribe to this podcast wherever you can. If you would like to be featured on the show or want to recommend an artist, email us at podcast@alsocoolmag.com. Thanks for listening.